despite popular memory, and despite what many American Jews think when they look back at Russia, there had not really been any large-scale pogroms in Eastern Europe for over 100 years, since 1768. So the pogroms in 1881, particularly in the aftermath of a more liberal regime, comes as a huge shock. And I was just at a conference last Sunday and Monday in Champaign, Illinois, at the University of Illinois, on Russian Jewish history, that was honoring the memory of a Russian Jewish historian named John Clear, who wrote several books, one including Russia Gathers Its Jews, where he really argues against the popular belief that Alexander III instigated the pogroms, and that the pogroms were somehow government sponsored. You know, and that's a belief that really made its way into all the historiography. And you know, if you would ask not just the average layperson today, knowledgeable layperson, but even some historians, they would tell you that the government instigated these pogroms. The truth is that having looked at the archival record, Clear and others concluded there's really no proof of this, and in fact there seems to be proof of the opposite, that the pogroms were rather spontaneous eruptions in various spots with different local police reacting in different ways. But leaving that aside, this sets a shockwave and sends a shockwave through the Russian Jewish world. And one response is early Zionism. Not to be too revisionist about this, but some recent historians have questioned just how pivotal 1881 is, and have argued that really the Russian Jewish intelligentsia was moving towards Zionism, was moving towards nationalism even before this, in the 1870s. But you have those who formed the early Zionist movement in Tsarist Russia come roughly from three groups. You have alienated, Russified intellectuals, Jews who had grown up or had adopted Russian culture, were not fluent in Hebrew and perhaps even in Yiddish, who were very involved in Russian cultural life, sometimes in Russian revolutionary life, before 1881, feel the sting of the pogroms, the sting of anti-Semitism. Even more shocking than the pogroms themselves was popular reaction and even intellectual reaction in Russia to it, with many people across the board of Russian public culture blaming the Jews themselves, saying that this is a result of Jewish economic exploitation of the peasants, etc. You didn't have this in the Russian Revolutionary Movement. And so many of these Russified Jews turn inward, and there's a return to the people. That's one group. A second group are many Maskilim. Maskilim, the popular definition of the term, a Maskil doesn't mean a modernized Jew, or it doesn't mean, as we often hear, in our community, an Afikoros who wanted to uproot, Kol HaTorah Kula, an Afikoros, a Maskil, you see what it does? A Maskil has a very definite historical term. A Maskil means somebody who, a Jew who was raised in traditional Jewish society, oftentimes, a male, almost by definition a male, although, we have a few examples of women Maskilot, a male who's raised in elite Jewish society in the Beis Medrash and Yeshiva world, who does not get any systematic secular education but gets an outstanding traditional Torah education. Then around the time that they're a teenager, starts reading secular books or some other books of medieval Hebrew philosophy in Hebrew translation. If it's secular books from the outside in Hebrew translation, unsystematically acquires a secular education as in an autodidactic fashion, and then starts questioning certain elements of traditional Judaism, but most of the time the periphery and not the core. Sometimes it'll be questioning certain aspects of Kabbalah or certain aspects of folk belief. And many Maskilim, most Maskilim, in fact, until the 1860s, are quite traditional observant Jews. In the 1860s, there was a radicalization of Haskalah, and at that point, you start having the call for by certain Maskilic figures like Moshe Leib Lilienblum and the poet Yehuda Leib Gordon. You start having the call for religious reform. Also, the religious reform that was most often called for was not along the line of West European reform, but for instance, in 1868, there was a drought in Russia, and there was a call by Maskilim calling on the rabbis to abolish the ban or to ease the ban on kitniyot, to allow Jews to eat kitniyot on Pesach. So that type of thing. So that's the second group. You have many of these Maskilim, such as Moshe Leib Lilienblum, who really believed in ultimate integration into Russian society and are really disillusioned. And the third group that joins, and they join Chibat Zion, and they turn to, if we can't have a proud life here in Russia, we'll try to create that in Eretz Yisrael. And there's a sense that, we will always remain strangers here. And of course, Leon Pinsker is a primary example, who wrote Auto-Emancipation, is a prime example of the first category, a Russified Jew who despairs of acculturation and integration and turns to Zionism and argues that the Jews will always be strangers in the diaspora and must settle in the land of Israel. Moshe Leib Lilienblum is an example of the second category. And the two of them join and officially form Chibat Zion. The third category is, what directly interests us today, and that is the rabbis. The traditional rabbinate, we could start, by the 1880s, we can refer to an Orthodox rabbinate. The term Orthodox, again, I use in a historical sense, that there are no Orthodox Jews before there are heterodox Jews, Jews who openly flout the tradition, out of ideological conviction, rather than just out of some personal idiosyncrasy. So you have so amongst the Orthodox rabbinate, there's a real debate: should we join this group or should we not join this group? On the one hand, we need to do something, and the situation in Russia is deteriorating, and there's a sense of terrible crisis. Hundreds of thousands of Jews are already voting with their feet by emigrating to America. In 1881, 1882, you have hundreds of thousands of Jews who are sneaking over the border into Galicia, into the Austro-Hungarian Empire, going to the city, the border town of Brody, and sleeping on the street, trying to get to the West. So what can the rabbinate, seeing itself as the spiritual leadership of the Jewish people in Russia, do? There are two opinions. One opinion is we cannot work with sinners. We cannot join a movement that's led by sinners. And they look at Chibat Zion and they see Pinsker and Lilienblum, one a relatively ignorant, a Jew who's ignorant of traditional Jewish sources, and Lilienblum, who is an apikoros, Lilienblum, who was an Eloi, who was chased out of his, who was the rav of his town in Lithuania, in Vilkomir, in the in his teens, and gets chased out for arguing for religious change and religious reform. On the other hand, so there are those who argue that we cannot work with sinners, and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik is a prime example of this. There was a group of Jewish students, university students from throughout Russia, who form a group in the early 1880s even in the beginning stages of Chibat Tzion called Bilu, you know, the acronym Beit Yaakov L'chuvan Elcha, from, you know, taken from the verse from Isaiah. And Reb Chaim was fond of saying, they take the first words of this pasuk, Beit Yaakov L'chuvan Elcha, but they leave out the last words, Be'or Hashem. Right. We can't work with them. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, you know, believed even more strongly that we can't work with them. However, there were, in the 1880s, there were a significant number of, right now let's not talk about the Hasidic world, we're going to talk about just the Lithuanian yeshiva world. There was a significant number of major Lithuanian rabbinic figures who argued otherwise, that indeed they could work with Chibat Tzion, that as long as the rabbis had control over religious affairs, they could work with sinners for the purpose of pikuach nefesh, of saving Jewish souls, and also the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So we have, here we have some very interesting letters. I just want to see what time we have till, what, 11:30? So for the rest of the time, rather than the lecture, we're going to look and read together some of the sections of these letters. We have some very interesting letters between the Netziv, who at that time, as you know, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin Yeshiva at the time. The Netziv who lived, I don't have the exact dates, I think 1817, and died in the 1890s, soon after the closing of the yeshiva. I believe he died in 1893. So the Netziv is quite an elderly man at the time. You know, is almost 70, which for the 1880s is elderly. And there's a fascinating exchange of letters between the Netziv and Leon Pinsker in Hebrew. It's important to say that the Netziv, while he was quite worldly, while he did read Hebrew newspapers avidly, did not know Polish or Russian. According to some sources, he regretted not knowing these languages, or at least certainly his father-in-law, Rav Itzala, regretted not knowing these languages. So he's writing in Hebrew. Leon Pinsker obviously doesn't read Hebrew, and certainly not fluently, so the letters are translated to him into Russian, and then he writes and it gets translated into, so we really see, the exchange here. And we get in these letters both that it seems theological attitude towards the yeshuv and building up Eretz Yisrael. And we also get from it, the sense of special responsibility of a religious leader towards this type of what this yeshuv has to look like religiously. So let's turn, right on the first page, the first letter. This was written in December 1885, as you see. If I could have a volunteer, I'm going to do this just like I do in my rebel class. I call on students to read, but the only difference is you don't have to be prepared. Start from the beginning. Ra'o Ra'inu.
Ra'o Ra'inu ki yaya Hashem esruach ha'ma Yisrael b'chol chokei seveil loa lo'shiv nachalot shom ma'zvit poetic. Lo'shiv nachalot shom ma'zvit poetic lo'chonen shom ma'shavos l'edchei Yisrael b'kol Hashem dofek al pischei l'hoven le'mor pischu v'pesach b'fula aschem ki gia asher asher lo ye omer od al Eretz Yisrael azuvavei d'reish osa de'atar sara me'ala kelelas Hashem tishitiya et shomeima uvod v'Hashem b'krisas b'ris le'mor v'horetz ezkor.
Okay, so assuming that most people in the room more or less understand, let's though at least just make a summary of what was just said, and in case the people might not understand, even so, just so we can. Yeah.
Well, basically, the Tziva is simply saying that we see now that there's a time when Hashem is actually helping for the, what should I say, rehabilitation of the land of Eretz Yisrael.
Right. That's right. The Netziv says that we see with our own eyes that that God is with the spirit of his people in all corners of the world to restore the ruins of the Holy Land and to restore their settlements of the dispersed people of Israel. God is knocking on the gates of our hearts, on the doors of our hearts, saying, "Open up a little room for your work. For the time has come that it will no longer be said the land of Israel will be forsaken." Right, and then he says, "Now comes the time for Hashem to fulfill his shvuah." You know that it says v'ha'aretz as kar. Where is that v'ha'aretz as kar? Exactly. The Tochachah b'chukosai v'yikra chavav membeis v'zacharti efriti Yaakov efriti Yitzchak efriti Abraham as kar v'ha'aretz as kar. So clearly, you know, very poetic language and very redemptive language, right? That this is really a redemption, and God is remembering the Jewish people. God is remembering the land. Now, in the next paragraph, which we'll just skip, he just basically says it's a mitzvah on everybody to give money, you know, to collect. If we're aniyim, we don't have a lot of money. Let's collect, you know, prutas, you know, whatever little we have, and do it. Now, if you continue reading in the third paragraph,
This, by the way, he says in the Hemet cover as well. Hainu b'mozak shamim shafah ha'aretz nased bushim kocha gam zarecha yimaneh. Hainu b'esha atzorot misrabot v'nishar enosh me'at mizair v'esahi kumis lech paretz v'chulu. Hainu b'viya sh'ach sh'achar galus alin l'salech paretz l'asot v'yishuvah teren nizkeh b'mer v'yameinu.
Okay, so let's take a little break here and give a little summary.
So, as I said, he has this parish in the Hemet Gemara.
He
says that the difference between the first entry in time of Yeshua, where they didn't have to do anything, was comparable to when Hashem first told Avram, just look around, and you already are zochet to it. But just like afterwards, Hashem says to Avram, you have to go in the land. So he says, after the galut, then now the people have responsibility to do pu'ulot in the land to once again reclaim it.
Right. So here he says, right, so the Netziv makes a distinction. He's interpreting the verse, and this is also from, you know, this is from his Chumash, you know, his Perush on the Chumash, Emek Davar. This is a pasuk from Bereshit Yud Gimel Ted Vav and Yud Zayin. Kia kol ha'aretz asher ata roeh. Right, the whole land. Hashem says to Abraham, the whole land that you see, l'cha et nena, I'm giving it to you, l'zaracha l'olam, and to your descendants forever. The samti et zaracha ke'afar ha'aretz. I will make your offspring like the dust of the land. Asher im yuchal ish livnot et afar ha'aretz, gam zaracha yimaneh. If it is impossible, you know, or if it is possible to count the dust of the land, so shall your offspring be counted. And so the Netziv, you know, comes up with a very ingenious interpretation that fits very well here, and he says that there's a difference that this verse is referring to different stages of the Jews taking possession of Eretz Yisrael. So he, at the beginning, where it says, the seeing comes with the Yerusha Rishona, with the first possession of the land at the time of Yoshua bin Nun, at the time of, you know, when the Jews first, Bnei Yisrael, first entered the land. And at that time, all they have to do is look at it. They don't have to take, you know, productive steps to possess the land. the land is completely, you know, in Devarim we see, you know, you're coming into a land with cities that you didn't build and all sorts of, you know, buildings you didn't build and granaries you didn't build, etc. But then comes the point, and I think this is, you know, really, you know, ingenious drash, where he says, "V'samti etzarachat ki'afar ha'aretz, I will make your offspring as the dust of the land." What? When will that be? That's the galus. That's the exile. Why will you be like dash? Called dashim aleihem. Everybody will trample on you, and you'll become gushim. You'll become like a clump. You'll become like a what's that? Like compacted, right? You'll become compacted. You know, meaning that there'll be less of you, and you'll be all, you know, you'll be downtrodden. At that time,
you have to do something.
You have to do something. That's right. Then kum hitalech ba'aretz. Then go walk in the land, take possession of it. And before you can actually take possession of it, you have to do something productive. You have to actually walk around. You can't just come and look at it. You have to walk around in it hitalech ba, which means to take possession of it in some productive way. Okay, you want to finish this paragraph?
This is also like when Sibu wanted to try everybody together.
This fits in so well with what I've read about it and seen in his Perusha. He talks about how Ezra brought everybody, not just the Azachlomach or the people who were zeros. He brought everybody together. He says, and then, just like then that they were successful, so he gives the bracha that they will be successful now to build up the land and lead to a society, to a matzah where they'll be shomer Torah mitzvahs.
That's right. Exactly.
What was the point of the letter? He was sending a letter to Insker. This one is more of a letter
Right. Encouraging, like it's when you have a tzedakah, you know, even to this day, what do? You put a gadol's name on it, right? And so here they, you know, Kibatzion contacted the Nitziv, and boy, he really plugged them, you know.
So it wasn't a response to the letter, whether or not he's a disapproving
right, not yet. We're going to get to those exchanges in a minute. But right now, you see, he clearly approves of Kibbutz Zion. So what he says here is, you know, what we have to do is, just like at the time, you know, he makes a historical parallel to Galut Bavel and to Ezra, who took out thousands of Jews from Babylonia. Amongst them were Gedolei Torah and Yirei Hashem, all the way to Mechallelei Shabbat, and people who were married to foreign wives. And he brings them to the land. They engage in all sorts of productive work to rebuild it. And we similarly have to do the same thing. So we see, you know, the Nitziv really envisions a redemptive potential to the Chibat Zion movement, that God has really remembered the land, has remembered the people, and the Jews have to do something productive and positive, you know, and active rather than passive, you know, to take possession of it and to take advantage of it. Now, the next letter that we're going to look at is, let's see how this works here. Okay. It's exactly the next one. This one he writes to the heads of Chibat Zion in the city of Warsaw. And he starts, with the first paragraph is great, you can read it on your own, where he says, if he would have realized that he would have been mentioned and the members of Chibat Zion and the legend would have been mentioned in their Michtav 8, in their periodical, he would have done more, he would have said more. You know, he puts in Midrash, it says, if Reuven would have realized that the Torah would have said, Vayishma Reuven v'yatzileu miyadam, you know, that Reuven heard the plan to kill Yosef and he decided to save him, that he would have taken him on his shoulders back to his father. Now, in the second paragraph, the Netziv lists two reasons, or two primarily theological aims of the Chibat Zion movement, you know, two good, positive goods that he could see coming out of it. Can I have another volunteer? And people are intimidated after that excellent reading. No test here. And anybody want to take a step? Okay, very good. Did he name two dots? Chasach. That's a difficult phrase. It's from Yeshaya Yud Dalet Pasuk Vav Murdach Bali Chasach, in relentless pursuit. So okay. No. This is Chasach, and this is Murdach. It's from straight from the Tanakh. Uh-huh. Okay. So what does he say here?
One reason is that.
Yeah, well, look at that, somebody said.
There are two reasons. One is to that we have to save Eretz Yisrael from the from this relentless pursuit, and to
actually
and to all the people that are. That the obstacles to Israel that don't want to have they don't want us to have a place for ingathering.
Actually, he's not talking about that here. He's talking about he's saying we see that. We see terrible years. You know, he's talking about here in Russia. Right, and the Jews are relentlessly persecuted. You need a photo op?
I don't want to disturb it. I'm just going to try to take some candid. So,
oh, okay.
So I apologize.
And many sinners, harbeit kolshei Yisrael, many, you know, those who stumble amongst the Jews, can no longer exist in the galut. In other words, what he's saying is that there's persecution, and the persecution is leading people astray from the Torah. What he's leading to is that somehow this will be rectified with a return to Eretz Yisrael. So he in his next sentence, read. Go ahead and read.
Spanya,
Portugal, Why don't you just give a little summary?
It's especially good that there is a place, surely Israel, a place where they could go to Israel, where they Yanu Aflehem, they could have a peaceful life for a while.
Right, they could rest a little bit, you know, rest from the persecution.
And also, more than this trouble, we see that the Hashgacha, God's Hashgacha, to return it to us, so that we should rebuild the
Nishmat
Ha'aretz, the soul of the land.
The desolation
right,
of the land.
Because wasn't it true that in the exile of Spain and Portugal, this hour was also given for our side to grasp the land?
Right, so what he's saying, what he's saying is that that clearly it's seen, we see from the events on the ground, the fact that Jews are returning to Eretz Yisrael, the fact that this movement is sprouted up, that it's hashgacha, that it's God's plan for the Jewish people to begin to return to Eretz Yisrael. And he says that and to rebuild the wastes of the land, the desolations of the land, he says, and the fact that we know it's hashgacha is because in the days after, you know, in the time of Gerush Sfarad, in after 1492 and the expulsion from Portugal in 1497, that would have been an even better time, l'cha'ora. But yet, it didn't happen. Right. Okay, does somebody else want to continue? Yeah.
V'hatugar Moshel Haaretz v'tach lifnei Yisrael sh'arei ארצו בזרועות פתוחות ובכל זאת לא עלה על דעת גדולי ישראל וחכמיהם להאחז בארץ אבותיהם ומזה אנו רואים כי אז לא הגיע עוד הרצון מלפני יתברך להושיב את הארץ ועתה אם כי התועלת עלינו לא גברה כל כך כי מה יכולים אנחנו בהשתדלותנו להציל כושלי ישראל. אכן עלינו להתחזק בזה מצד שאנו רואים כי כך סבב בעל הציבור התברך עלינו להשכיל כי אחר שהארץ ההיא נקראת על שמו התברך לשון המקרא אלוקי הארץ ועיני השם בא בייחוד מובן הדבר שהוא התברך חפץ בישובה על כי הוצרך משה רבינו והוציא מלב ישראל שלא יחשבו שמן הנמנע שיגיע חורבן הארץ על ידי אבונותיהם. וזאת הוכיח בפרשת שלמה.
שלמה.
בפרשה שלמה. אל תאמר בלבבך שלא יחשבו. כי כמו ש...
אף על גב.
שהרשיעו הכנענים מאוד לא הורישם השם. תהיים על ידי שהושיב את ישראל כך לא יהיו נגרשים מן הארץ להיות שממה כי אין אומה טובה מישראל להושיבם בה על זה הוכיח משה רבינו כי אין דבר שעומד בפני הדין הקשה כי מואר הכל בדורי האמת
האמת שבא. Okay, so you want to give a little summary of what he's saying so far?
I'm trying. Uh-huh. Okay, I don't know what Tugar is, but it's about...
Tugar, the Turkey.
Okay. Uh-huh. So, the ruler of the Turkish ruler of Israel, uh-huh. He opened the gates of Israel in a welcoming manner, uh-huh. And even though it was possible for, you know, to go up to Israel, that Gdolei Israel, they didn't have in mind to go to Israel.
Right. And right. This is all talking about at the time in the 16th century, following the expulsion from Spain. Yeah. That it was a more seemingly it was a more fortuitous time. Why? Because the Turks really wanted, you know, they opened their lands to the Jews. So the Jews could have flooded into Eretz Israel, but they didn't.
The Turks were also in his time.
They were still in his time, but in his time they weren't as open to it as they were 400 years before, is what he's saying. Yeah, okay.
And And from this we see that it wasn't really the time that Hashem wanted Loshiv et Israel Be'eretz
Yisrael. Right.
So, but
then it gets into
what
does
it mean to'elet?
To'elet, the purpose.
Okay.
The goal, yeah.
So the purpose was not so important for us. Is that what it means?
Oh, I think it was Ata'im ki atoelet alena loka brako kafa.
It's more than purpose. It's the good that comes out.
Yes, but in this case, it also means even if there's not so much that we can do. That's what he's saying, right? Because he's saying, kima yichumim anachnu.
What can we do when we want to save koshli adapikosim, you know? We have to strengthen ourselves that we see that Hashem, you know, he turns things the way he does and we have to be wise about it. Because the land is called the land of Hashem, Elokei HaAretz.
Right.
And Hashem watches over it specifically. Of course, it's understood that Hashem wants us to settle the land.
Right, right. Then he gets into a whole Dvar Torah about that unfortunately we probably don't have time to go into, but so what we see here is that he says that it's really God's plan that we settle the land and God has set it up this way that it should happen. And then he says, look down a few lines, he says after Haimek Davar Sham, he says Achin Atash Anu Roim Shahashkacha Mivyali Dekach. Right, we see that God's providence has brought us to this. It's upon us to pursue and to make our to attempt to do our hishtadlus, right? B'chol ha'efshar, as all possible, to buy up and to plant, and as God said to Yitzchak, shchon ba'aretz, you know, where this is in Breishit, where Hashem tells Yitzchak not to go down to Mitzrayim at a time of famine, but he says, shchon ba'aretz, right? Dwell in this land. B'darshu b'Breishit Rabbah, Pasuk Dalet, aste shchuna ba'aretz, make a neighborhood or a dwelling in the land, having noteya, having zoreya, having netziv, right? Plant and sow and be afagav shaloh harbeha ya yachol Yitzchak levado lahoshiv et haaretz bizmano shahaita tachad memshelat haknanim vahaplishtim. You know, how much could Yitzchak Avinu had done at that time to take control of the land? It was under the rule. You know, here he's making an explicit comparison to the rule of the Turks. He said, then it was under the rule of the Philistines, the Plishtim, and the Canaanites. Mikom makom, haya yakar b'nei Hashem ma'ashe yoshiv Yitzchak. It was dear in Hashem's eyes, precious in Hashem's eyes, that which Yitzchak restored. Kachaleinu ladat sheyakar b'nei Hashem, it is precious in God's eyes. Ma'ashe noshiv anachnu b'maase yadenu, that which we restore with our own hands. Va'afilu tachat memshelat ha'togar, even under the rule of the Turks. Then he goes on to say, we'll just read this paragraph quickly. He says, "V'af gam zot ein lanu lishol v'lachkor madua be'emet lo hayta siyata dishmaya b'mei galut shbanya lahavienu lidekach v'hayom higia sha'al l'ratzon zeh v'chi achsher dara." We shouldn't ask, why was it that, why did Hashem make it that now the conditions are such that Jews are returning to Eretz Yisrael? We think, when according to our conception, it should have been at the time of after the Spanish expulsion. So he says, "Ach hanistarot l'Hashem Elokeinu, you know, hanistarot l'Hashem Elokeinu, v'haniglo lanu l'vanenu adalam lasot bechol divrei Torah zot," right? And uchamosh ein lanu lachkor madua alav machshava lahacharif eretz aseret hashvatim bimei Hoshea ben Elah yoter bimei Achav shehirba laharshia mei Hoshea. Just like we can't ask why was it that it was under the watch of Hoshea ben Elah, who was the king of the north, when the 10 tribes were expelled, when Ahab was actually a much bigger Rasha than he was, right? But yet it happened under his watch. B'chein galut Yehuda b'mei Tzidkiyahu. Why did the galut Yehuda, why did Nebuchadnezzar exile Judea at the time of Tzidkiyahu and not v'lo b'mei Menashe shehir b'el harshia mimenu, who was a worse Rasha than him? Ela hanistarot l'shem elokeinu. We can't make chachmas and try to figure out why it's happening now. Haniglot lanu ki acharesh nidorer ha-ra'ayon bekerev Yisrael v'katzei ha'olam v'akatzeihu b'chol makom asher anachnu mfuzarim v'kol hamon k'kol shakai b'dabro ha-yedei nivyav v'al kein aleinu lihi mashech acharei kol dvar rav zeh. So this is very nice. What he says is, and he says something very actually theologically significant. He says, how do we know that this is indeed God's plan? Right? We know it because the idea has taken off amongst Jews throughout the world, from one side of the world to the other. Yeah,
it seems a little convenient for the, he's just presenting the historical context, and now we know it's true because now it's working out. But it doesn't, it seems a little convenient for his point. It doesn't seem
well, but at his time, it's not working out so well. I mean, you know what I mean? At his time, yes, the idea ideologically is starting to take off, but you know how many. How many settlers really are there to Eretz Yisrael in the 1880s? You know, a couple thousand at most. You know, compare that to hundreds of thousands of Jews, you know, lining up to go to America.
It's not the first time in history that there were settlers in Eretz Yisrael.
Right.
So right. It's convenient that it happened to work out.
But what do you mean? Convenient for us in retrospect?
No, it's convenient for the natives. Worldview on this Geula.
Uh-huh. I think that's what his point is, though, by saying that the interest is worldwide, and the actions of these groups are starting to form worldwide. It's something that hadn't happened before in history.
Right? That's right.
There's nothing inherent that demonstrates that it's more than circumstance.
He's giving from the Torah. He's giving different reasons why we have the right to go and start going to Israel. In contrast to, that's what I'm trying to, I want to think, to, all the people in Israel, have a totally opposing, take it differently, say that we can't go to Eretz Yisrael because Hashem's going to be the one to take us there.
Right.
So he's pointing out from the Torah why we should be able to
go. So first of all, it certainly seems like the Nitziv isn't concerned about the Shalosh Shavuos. You know that
he just lost his yeshiva.
What's that?
Yeshiva's closed down. He's got no job. You know.
What? No, that's not true. That's not true.
1885.
No, 1885. The yeshiva's still thriving. The yeshiva closes in 1892.
1892.
Yeah. Okay, So the yeshiva's still thriving, and in fact. In Volozhin, there's some quite active Chibat Zion cells. Well, what is his relation to Chibat Zion, you know, Zionist activity going on in his yeshiva? His attitude is mixed. He officially forbids Zionist cells in his yeshiva, but unofficially, he doesn't care. But you know, but that doesn't mean that he's anti Chibat Zion. He's very pro Chibat Zion. It means that when his students are in yeshiva, he wants them learning, and he doesn't want anything to take away from the Torah, including social action, even if he thinks that social action is very positive. Yeah.
I think there's two things. First of all, the Tziv has a shita in general that Dvar Hashem is often seen in history,
right,
in historical action. So the fact that it's convenient is not the point. The fact that it's convenient is Dvar Hashem. Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened. That's the point. That's why he contrasts what happens by the exile of Spain. The exile of Spain should have happened because the Turks were open, the Jews were driven out, they had to go somewhere, and right. they didn't, and they didn't call
right. And they go to the Turkish Empire, they go to the Ottoman Empire, just not that in
Israel.
To Israel, right. Yeah.
I'm not sure what's not concerned about the Shal Shavuot. In the prior year, we heard that one of the Jerusalem, one of the Shal Shavuot, the Jews do it little by little.
Yes. Yeah. What I mean by not concerned about, of course he's probably concerned, what I mean is he doesn't see settlement of Eretz Yisrael as a violation of, what is it? Of the Shalosh Shavuot. So I see we have 5 minutes left, so we're not going to obviously get to all the sources, but I want to say that with settlement of Eretz Yisrael and with the redemptive potential of settling Eretz Yisrael in the Nitziv's mind comes heightened responsibility. Now, and this is where the potential pitfalls lie. He talks about the second goal. He says that that's the first goal of settling in Eretz Yisrael, the goal of taking possession of the land, of a refuge for Jews from Tsarist Russia. But then he says the second goal is uniting all Jews, throughout the world. But he says that we have to be very careful. He said, and he talks about another society, the Kol Yisrael society, where Jews were united, but not under the banner of Torah. And he argues that this kind of uniting of the Jews has to be done under the Torah. So here comes the limits of his, of his tolerance, as it were, or of his, he's not really a pluralist in the modern sense. He believes that, this has to be done under the banner of Torah. And if you turn the page, you see.
Does he reconcile that with the Kibbutz Zion movement, which primarily is not under the banner of Torah?
Well, we'll see how he does that. Let's see if we can reach, let's look at one, at a paragraph here and see what happens. And then since we're running low on time, I'll give you a summary of some of the letters with him and Pinsker. You can read them, take them home, and read them on your own. You see the last paragraph on page 178. He says, "Ki aleinu ladat asher afilu mitzvot she'inan tluyot ba'aretz, ba'afilu mitzvot sichliot she'dat enoshi machuichan rak shehem ha'mepurashim b'dvar Hashem b'torato akdosha, azai af al gav she'anu muzharim aleihem." Mikol makom yoter anu muzarin aleihem be'eretz Yisrael uscharam ve'onsham sham harbe yoter mibechutz la'aretz kemefarish ba'aseret hadibrot kaved et avicha laman yarichun yamech ha'al ha'adama ve'elanu mitzvah shedat enoshim mizaheret aleha yoter mimitzvah kibud avaim u'mikol makom nikparish haschar ba'adama asher Hashem noten lanu u'mikol shekein mitzvah she'en hadat notznan behein chukei haTorah, af al gav she'anu muzarin aleihem b'chol makom, mikol makom aleinu leizaher b'yoter b'paltin shel melech malchei hamelachim hakadosh baruch hu. Okay, so what he says is that even mitzvot she'enan tluyot ba'aretz, there are two categories of mitzvot hatluyot ba'aretz. This is one way of categorizing mitzvot. Mitzvot hatluyot ba'aretz, mitzvot that are bound to the land of Eretz Yisrael, and mitzvot she'enam tluyot ba'aretz, mitzvot that are not bound to the land. Even the ones that are not bound to the land, the stakes of keeping them are higher. Their reward and punishment is higher in Eretz Yisrael than anywhere else in the world. And he says, even mitzvot sichliot, even the mitzvot that we understand the reasons that are rational mitzvot, such as honoring your mother and father, there's no more rational mitzvah than that. And yet, what's the reward? L'man yarichun yamecha al ha'adamar sh'nishvashem l'kecha latev lach. In order that you have length of days on the land which Hashem your God gave you, and he says how much more so that the chukim, the statutes that we don't understand. We have to be more careful in the palace of the king, meaning Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, is the palace of the king, and so we have to be much more careful with mitzvot there than we would in the exile. ומשום זה התחזקו עזרא נחמיה להבדיל את עולי הגולה מחילול שבת קודש ומנשים נוכריות אשר הוזהרנו באלה גם בבבל וככה עלינו להיזהר ולרשום בתקנת היישוב אשר כמו שאנו משתדלים להושיב אנשים שהם מוכשרים להיות עובדי אדמת הקודש ככה עלינו להשתדל שיהיו עולים לארץ ישראל שומרי תורה הכתובה והמסורה b'li shum hitchakmut chas v'shalom, v'rak be'emunat oman kidat rabotenu rabu v'niskavu midatam v'af va'ach al pi atamud v'godrei petach hatchatat ashe lefetach roveitz anu kayamim ba'olam v'tar am b'li avdan surat Yisrael. V'hu ashereinu b'goyim. Okay, now, so he says that just as, and we see, so it wasn't as open-minded as we first thought, you know, where he said that look at the Babel, Ezra brought in the Mechalei Shabbos and the people who had foreign wives. This is saying, well, he said, yes, he brought them in, but what did he do? He made them get rid of their wives, and he made them start keeping Shabbos. The same thing, too, just as we want good workers, people who physically can work, are capable of working the land, so too we want people who are good spiritually for the land, who will observe, you know, the mitzvot. What ensues, and I see we're out of time, but what ensues is a series of letters between Pinsker and the Nitziv, in which the Nitziv gets word about some Chilul Shabbat and other, you know, and other non-observance in some of the new communities of Chivat Zion, such as Gedera, in the new Yeshuv. He's very upset about it, and he argues that the following should be done. First of all, he argues that he thinks in Gedera, he thinks that the situation is so bad that it can't be rectified, and he actually argues that at that time the Baron Rothschild had taken over financial control of these yeshuvim. He argues that Rothschild should give these people a one-way ticket one-way tickets on a boat out of Palestine, and he should import religious people from the old yeshuv from Yerushalayim to settle on the agricultural colonies, which he says, by the way, would solve their financial, you know, their economic woes. And what should happen at the other in the other yeshuvim? There should be a religious overseer who should, you know, come to the yeshuv, who should make sure that they're observing the halakha. They should bring in a magid who preaches on Shabbos about trumas and masros, you know, who talks about, you know, tithes and the mitzvot atluyot ba'aretz, and, you know, that this is extremely important. And he even says, you know, that the whole future and state of the yeshuv is dependent on it. And he quotes, you know, the second paragraph of Shema, that, you know, it's the rain is dependent on it, etc. So, you know, in conclusion, you know, what do we see? We see that the Nitziv did see redemptive potential in Chibat Zion. He was willing to work with non-observant Jews, you know, for the sake of settling Eretz Yisrael. Although he didn't use the term Akalta de Geula, you know, we see something like this, you know, approximating this in his thought. At the same time, he's only willing to work with the sinners on condition that that religious matters are left in control of, you know, the rabbis, and that the settlers be observant. And he's willing to enforce this, you know, by what we would say are, you know, non-democratic, you know, means. Now, you know, just, you know, we're out of time, but, you know, a fascinating book, if any of you are interested in seeing the whole relationship, you know, chronicled between the Orthodox, between the rabbis and the Chibat Zion movement and the early Zionist movement. There's a wonderful book by Ehud Luz, a professor at the University of Haifa, called Parallels Meet. And you know, Parallels Meet talks about this relationship between the rabbis and Chibat Zion from the early 1880s until about World War I. Basically, you know, a regel achat, this relationship of the Nitziv and of other major religious figures lasts with Chibat Zion in sort of an uneasy tension until 1889. In 1889, there was a Shemitah year, and the yeshuv and many secular leaders of Chibat Zion and many of the settlers want to find a halachic way out, you know, a heter mechira. Many rabbis don't want to do this, and the whole movement splits over this, and most rabbis leave the movement in Lithuania over this. A small group stays in the movement, particularly focused around Reb Shmuel Mohilever and Reb Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, and you know, to form to eventually to form Mizrahi. It gets more complicated in the 1890s when Achad Ha'am comes on the scene, and Achad Ha'am introduces cultural Zionism, and this is a movement that none of the rabbis can reconcile themselves with, because cultural Zionism seeks to create a modern secular national culture that very much would be instead of a religious culture. So all the rabbis are against this. But some stay with the movement and many leave. Thank you. What's your name?
There's so much in this letter that I see in the
Take care. In the